Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about investing and saving for retirement with a financial advisor. Brendan Dorone, our guest, back once again. He's CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. And as we talk with him, you know, times are, I mean, we were just listening on the news to what's going on in Washington and the problems there. And I think it's actually caused a whole lot of people to start thinking about their own retirement and are they going to have enough money and, you know, when the time comes. And I'm wondering about you. Do you expect to be financially secure after retirement? You want to feel that way? At least give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Brendan, welcome back to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, glad to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at kind of at the beginning in a way. What are the responsibilities for a financial advisor when it comes to working with a client?
You know, first off, listen, understand their perspective and goals, and you know, figure out what their desires are, at least in the realms of financial plans, and then help them accomplish their goals.
And you often, I've spoken to a number of financial planners over the years and have a person that I work with, and the conversation often revolves around a diversified investment portfolio. What does that really mean?
You can take the common colloquialism of don't have all your eggs in one basket, but you know, different sectors perform differently. And if you are only in, you know, small cap stocks or large cap stocks, you will have more volatility or, you know, change in return. Whereas if you can spread your investments among different sectors, you'll get a smoother return, will be more, you know, comfortable, and over the long run, actually will perform better than having everything in one sector in itself.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Jim's already sent an email. They're planning to recharacterize some of their IRA this year, and the bill passed by Congress earlier this year increases the standard deduction for seniors. Jim's over 65. What beneficial tax impact might this have after doing the conversion?
Well, you know, first of all, being able to convert dollars with the higher deduction allows them to do that at a lower tax rate. And the assumption is that if you can, you know, pay less taxes today, have it grow tax-free and take it out tax-free, you are in control of your own destiny. One of the things that people say a lot is, you know, do you want to be in business with the government and they decide what your taxes are? We don't know what tax rates are going to be in the future, and they can change. And if you have money in a Roth IRA, you remove that issue, you know, from the table.
Yeah, and that's what a Roth does versus a traditional, right?
Correct. A traditional is you get a deduction today, and we know what rate that's going to be at your top marginal. But when you take it out, it's going to be all ordinary income at whatever rate, you know, you're going to be. The premise is that when you're retired, you don't have income come in, and therefore you should be at a lower tax rate. But I often see that, you know, if people have all of their money in qualified investments or IRAs, they are making, you know, just as much ordinary income in retirement as they are when they were working, especially if they have a little more free time and time to spend doing other things that cost money.
So what is, how much can you put into a Roth? Can you just put everything you want in there or what?
No, you have both limits on individual and, you know, 401k Roth IRAs. But if you're under 50, the limit this year is 7,000. Over 50, it's 8,000. So you get to put in a little more catch up if you're over 50.
But that that really adds up over time. And is there? I think I remember reading.
There's some income limit.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So that's assuming that your modified adjusted gross income is less than $146,000, and that's, you know, adjusted for inflation, goes up every year. But this year, it's $146,000. Mm. It starts to get phased out, $230,000 for married couples. Mm.
I've heard this. I've talked to some people that say who are advisors that say, well, the IRAs are not as good as investing directly in stocks and bonds and mutual funds.
Well, that would sort of be a blanket statement, and I don't like blanket statements at all. It really depends on individuals, you know, personal, you know, situation and where they are from an income perspective and what their goals are. IRAs, you know, absolutely make sense. But some individuals, you know, you with directing, investing directly, you know, you can have a step up at basis and death and can be a better, you know, transfer to the next generation from investing. But individually, I think IRAs, Roth IRAs, both make sense for most individuals.
John wonders about fiduciary financial advisors versus financial advisors. Can you explain the differences?
Yeah, so a fiduciary is obligated to act in the best interest of, you know, their client. They often are set up that they, you know, charge a fee, not a commission. If you take a commission, which some do, then you're not a fiduciary because you are conflicted with, you know, that commission. I think both, you know, fee only or traditional, you know, advisors, both are good. You know, are there bad apples out there? Yes, there can be bad apples on both sides, but yeah, that's a fiduciary is a fee relationship and they're charging a fee versus taking a commission. That's the high level difference.
Yeah. And probably based on some level of the fee is probably based on some level of money that the person might be in helping.
Yeah. There's different fee structures. Typically it's an AUM fee or an assets under management fee. But I know other, you know, fiduciaries that just charge an hourly fee or they charge a retainer. There's a lot of different ways that you can set that up as long as the customer understands, you know, what they're getting and what they're paying for. And you know, if your advisor is receiving a commission, there's still a cost to the client to that. It's ultimately borne, you know, by the client, but how it gets paid is sometimes a little different.
Yeah. How does a client's age determine the investment advice you might give them, or does it make a difference?
I mean, it does, but I would say it's more based on their death. But the older they get, the more likely death is imminent. And since we don't know exactly when people are going to die, their age is the best indicator of how long their investing horizon is. So it more has to do with how long do you have to invest? What sort of, you know, risks and fluctuations can you tolerate as you get older or as you're in retirement? You want to have, I guess, less fluctuation in the value. So that's where it would vary on age.
So what's the difference? I mean, what would be low risk versus high risk investments?
You know, the classic, you know, 70-30 or 60-40 stocks, bonds, you know, model. Stocks inherently are riskier than bonds, although they both have, you know, they both have risk. As you get closer to retirement, you want to have more of your assets in safe vehicles, call it bonds, you know, CDs, fixed annuities, things that are less volatile, less likely to move. And use those to draw your income out of, but you still need some higher yielding investments, stocks, to keep up with inflation.
What should the relationship be with your financial advisor when it comes to, I'm thinking about the person that I work with, usually twice a year we'll get on the, we'll talk, either meet in person or be a Google Meet or something, and go through a whole series of how are you, you know, what it, where am I in my situation financially, and she asks a lot of questions about where I'm, you know, where I'm going and things of that nature, which I actually kind of like those personal meetings once or twice a year.
Yeah, I would say at a minimum, you want to have a meeting at least annually to touch base, make sure that, you know, any developments on your end are shared and, you know, reassess the market as much as, you know, I would say quarterly is pretty common as well. There are some people who are particular and really concerned about the market and need to meet more often than that. That being said, I don't know that that's necessary, but somewhere between meeting quarterly and annually would be what I would think, you know, the typical advisor and client relationship should be.
I was thinking about this. I receive via online or sometimes in print, mailed to me. Here's kind of what this various things that you're invested in are doing, but they may not include. They include the broad range of investments, but not specifically where I'm at.
And this is from your financial advisor?
Well, this actually wasn't mine. I was talking to somebody else this morning who was expressing frustration at trying to read the amount of information and how the heck does it really apply to me? Why can't I just get told, you know, where I'm at in relation to what I'm investing in?
Yeah, and I think, again, that's where working with a financial advisor can be helpful. They can create an individualized plan for you, put your investments in there, and yeah, that can relate to what, you know, given what your investments are, what can you expect for an income stream, and including mm-hmm. Social Security and other things in there, so you know what you can spend in retirement.
Yeah. Brendan Nerone, our guest today, he is the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. Talking with him about investing for retirement and questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are getting some financial advice today from Brendan Nerone of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. He's the CEO of that company. At noon today, we'll talk about daylight savings time from an indigenous perspective with Rochelle Wilson-Tolomar. She is a lecturer in Spanish Environmental Cultural Studies at UW-Madison and enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation. And at 12:30, we'll talk about truffles and truffle research with two academics from UW-La Crosse. But right now, financial advice. And again, join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. What do you tell people when they come in and say, I really can't afford to make investments toward retirement, or that much? I can't afford to put that much into retirement.
Well, and Larry, as we talked about last time, I don't directly work with clients, but when I used to do that, the common thing that I would get would be, I need to retire in 5 years, and I'd look at what they have, and you know, they have hardly anything put away. I mean, it's investing in your future. Delayed gratification is one of the hardest things to do and not what our society, I think, is built on today. But if you can deal with the short-term pain of not having things to invest in your future, it's going to pay dividends in the long run.
Yeah, it's Sometimes I think I was thinking about some state workers I was talking to, and they said, well, you know, we're not making as much money as we might have made in the commercial world, let's say. But part of that reason was because we're getting money put into investments for us, and the state retirement system is a pretty darn good investment. And so I didn't get a new snowmobile or a new this or that, but here I am now getting ready to retire, and I've got some more money.
Yeah, both my grandparents were part of the Wisconsin retirement system, and my grandpa always commented, he used to be a police officer, that he made more in retirement than he ever did when he was working. And, you know, it was true. And it was, you know, a great system for him. And, you know, in that case, it's, you know, they're not directly investing, but because they're making less, you know, it's effectively the same way.
Yeah. What are the most common mistakes you think people make when it comes to planning for retirement?
Not starting soon enough, as you've indicated. And I think, you know, whether it be if you're in a governmental plan or, 401k, having some of those dollars taken directly out of your paycheck, whether it be, you know, pre-tax for 401k or post-tax for Roth 401k, is helpful. As soon as, you know, as soon as it hits your checking account, you want to spend it. But if it never makes it there, it's a whole lot easier not to spend it. So start early. And then I guess the other, on the flip side, I see people that are afraid to spend their money in retirement because they're afraid that, you know, they're going to run out. And if you've got a well-structured plan and you've got, you know, let's call it Social Security, some annuities with lifetime income, you know that you're going to have income for the rest of your life. And if you do that, you know, it's your money to spend. You worked hard to save it and make it all those years. You should spend it in retirement.
Yeah, I see people wanting to save all their money to give to their kids. And I mean, I even think a little about that myself, you know, with my own kids. I want to help them out when I can. But at the same time, you ought to be willing to spend a little of it yourself.
Yep. As I say to my mom, who is probably listening, you can spend your money. It'll be okay. You know, my sister and I don't need it. We'll be fine. You should spend it.
Oh, Brendan DeRoe, our guest. Question for him. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. We're having some trouble. We're getting lots of calls, but we're having some trouble getting our callers online, which is unfortunate. But we'll get that figured out, and we'll be able to get you on. So keep calling 800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. What about saving for college? We got an email on that. How do you help people save to go to college?
Yeah, as I have a senior in high school right now and a sophomore, top of mind issue for me, and it's you know, it's not cheap. You know, there are plans like 529 plans. You know, personally, I have a life insurance policy with cash value built up. That is what I'm, you know, going to be using, you know, for my kids, assuming they don't get scholarships, which I'm afraid to say, I don't think they're going to get full rides anywhere. again, it's having to plan ahead of time, make sure that you've got dollars saved. You know, you can also do, you know, the FAFSA and other things to help get aid, but college is not cheap. And if you didn't plan on having that expense coming up, it's going to be painful.
I think we've got getting our calls straightened out here. So, and we've got Matt in Oshkosh online with a question. Let's go there. Matt, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey there. I was just calling to get some advice on where to set up a Roth IRA, either with your bank or a private firm, and the pros and cons of each.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can go either route, and a bank, you know, a lot of banks have financial advisors. I mentioned this last time I was on, I'm a big fan of NAIFA, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. You know, the members commit to education, ethics, and doing what's right for their clients. You can, you know, look up to find a NAIFA member online, and I would start there. There are some that, you know, are going to be in banks. There are some that are going to have private practice. But if they're a NAIFA member, they should be, you know, a very reputable individual.
Are there a lot of different types of Roth IRAs?
Roth IRA, I mean, that's sort of a wrapper around the investment. You can have a CD that's in a Roth IRA. You can have mutual funds. It is the tax treatment, not the underlying investment itself.
That makes a lot of sense. What about debt? How do you advise people to deal with their debts or paying back what they owe?
I mean, it's important to pay back what you owe and sign up for. I mean, I believe in limiting debt. There are, you know, there's some things that make a lot of sense to have debt on, a house being one of them, having a mortgage, you know, having your mortgage interest be deductible if you itemize, you know, that's good debt to have. Credit card debt, you know, auto debt, that's a depreciating asset. Those debts are less, you know, appealing in my mind. If it's something that, you know, you have to do to, you know, in order to buy a car, I understand it. But I would look at a used car versus a new car then, because, again, it's a depreciating asset. And you want to have, you know, you want to minimize the debt that you can. That's an expensive, it doesn't help you accumulate dollars for retirement. It does just the opposite.
I was helping out a family member once with this a little while back, and looking at the credit cards, three credit cards, and they were all 29.9% or something like that interest. I couldn't.
Yeah, it's usury rates at best.
I was so mad. I dug into my own savings and paid them off, and then allowed the person to pay me back interest free with about the same amount of money they were paying for the credit cards, except they got that paid off really a lot quicker when it wasn't 30% interest being charged.
Yeah, I mean, that it basically doubles itself every 3 years. Or just a little more than, and I mean, very hard to ever, you know, get ahead.
Yeah. Barnaby and Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Barnaby. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I am old enough that I've lost quite a bit on 401ks. I twice had the value of a 401k wiped out in the last 30 years. And I'm really beginning to wonder that the only people who really make money from 401ks are the money traders, the stockbrokers, and the people who get the fees, versus I think companies should have stayed with pensions. I think pensions would have been better for everybody than throwing everyone's money into a very speculative stock market. Hmm. What's your opinion?
I would be interested to know what you were invested in, that it got wiped out entirely. I mean, especially if you were diversified. That being said, I like pensions. I think pensions were really a good tool for helping people retire and for the business to, you know, retain and reward their employees. You need to stay with a company for a long time in order to, you know, have your pension be effective. That being said, companies found that a 401k and doing a match is a much cheaper option than supporting a pension. And so by and large, a lot of companies have gotten rid of pensions and gone to the 401k. I disagree with your comment that the only people that make money on that are the, you know, the stockbrokers or traders or investment individuals involved with that. As you know, I have a lot of, I guess, anecdotal stories of people being, you know, done quite well with 401ks. But I'm, again, I'd be intrigued to see why yours lost all of its value.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. Let's put it that way. It almost would be as though the investment itself was in one company or something.
Yeah, I mean, if it was in their, you know, company stock, and he happened to work at Enron, well, then that would make sense to me. But outside of that,
yeah,
I struggle.
Ingrid and Madison emailed to say they have a traditional and a Roth IRA. Both are invested in mutual funds. Ingrid read somewhere that ETFs offer more flexibility and possible tax advantages. Ingrid says they have never understood the difference between these types of funds. Can you clarify the pros and cons? Also, can you move money from a traditional IRA into a Roth, or are most Roth contributions, must they be earned income?
Yeah, so you can do a conversion from an IRA to a Roth IRA. You're going to need to pay taxes in the year that you do that. But yes, you can move them from that standpoint, but there's a tax cost in doing so. An ETF, you know, that's an exchange traded fund. It's a basket of investments, very similar to, you know, a mutual fund. And again, I think with her question being, you know, IRA, Roth IRA, again, that's the wrapper around the investments. ETFs can be a little more efficient from a cost perspective in, you know, what you can do. And you can trade them intraday, but we're getting pretty deep in the weeds there.
Yeah. When does it make sense, another email, when does it make sense to open a new credit card?
That's a good question.
I think the person is coming from some. I'll tell you, my rating is 829 right now.
That's strong.
That's pretty strong, but when I get some emails from the financial folks, and they'll say, well, you could even make it better. Well, 850 is the most you can get if you opened another credit card. I only have two credit cards. And they say it would help if you had more credit cards. And I never understood the reasoning behind that.
I mean, you got to have... I mean, the more credit you have, quote unquote, available that you don't use, I think the more helpful it can be to your ratings. So from that standpoint, you know, opening a credit card that you're not carrying a balance on could help your score. To answer the original question, I mean, if they're trying to consolidate debt and a credit card has, you know, 6 months free or, you know, 12 months free interest, and they could use that to, you know, pay down the rate aggressively and get off, you know, a 30% charge, like you were saying before. I mean, that would make sense if, you know, you, and I don't know who would want to fly right now with the airlines being in the situation that they are. But, you know, I have an airline card that makes a lot of sense for me, but I travel a whole lot. You know, I think, If you want some of the associated benefits, you know, maybe that can make sense, but I don't exactly know where the person's coming from.
Emergency funds. Let's turn to that, because there's been some questions about that. How much emergency fund money do you have, and how do you balance, all right, I've got to have an emergency fund, but I also want to invest. So there's a balance there, too.
There is. An emergency fund is priority number one, in my opinion, and ideally have 6 months, at least 3 months, but really 6 months of, you know, living expenses, especially if I were a government worker and the, you know, government might shut down. Having some living expenses would be helpful. But yeah, make sure you've got that emergency fund set up first, because it's, you know, to the scenario before about having debt, if you have to go into debt because you have some unexpected expenses and didn't have an emergency fund, then it's going to be really hard to dig out of that.
Yeah, it is indeed. And those, and where do you put those emergency funds? You don't just leave them in your checking account or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you want something liquid. So, I mean, some people leave them, you know, in a checking or savings account. I mean, I would go in a savings account or a money market fund that had some decent yield, you know, 3-4% range, get, you know, some return on the money. Mm-hmm. But again, this isn't necessarily a long-term investment. It is, we want to have short-term and we need to have liquidity.
Brenda Derone, our guest today, the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona, and great to have him back as we talk investing with him. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email. The email address, talk@wpr.org. Colleen had emailed to ask, which companies do you invest in?
The sort of the one stipulation my broker dealer gives me around talking on the radio is to give any specific investment advice on companies. That really is individual to the person on what their risk tolerances are. And, you know, so I'll refrain from answering a specific investment company. But I would say I'm diversified in both, you know, mutual funds, some bonds. I also have, you know, cash value insurance, like I said before.
Yeah. And what's the, maybe talk about your company, because you've got insurance right in the company name. So what services do you provide as a company?
Yeah, so we are an insurance wholesaling firm. So we typically work with financial advisors, both fee-based and fee-only, to help, you know, provide insurance solutions, those being life insurance, annuities, long-term care, and disability income. Those are the four major pillars of insurance that we help.
And how important is it to have insurance? I mean, when we're talking about those kinds of insurances.
Yeah, I think they're all very important at different life stages. But if you have a family and they're dependent on your income, having life insurance for income replacement in case you don't come home from work that day, how are you going to replace that income? Disability income, if you get sick or hurt and, you know, can't work, where's that income going to come from? And yeah, we talked about having, you know, a short-term, you know, safety net. But what if you have a long-term disability? How are you going to get?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I said that's where disability income makes. Long-term care, as you get older, what's your plan for needing care in retirement? If you need to go to a nursing home, you know, are you going to get care at home? Are you going to get it at a facility? And then how are you going to pay for that? Are you going to use your investments to do that? Or are you going to leverage that risk with some sort of long-term care policy? And then annuities we talked about before, you know, an accumulation vehicle, but then also provide an income stream in retirement that you can't outlive.
Brenda Derone, our guest today, as we talk investing with him. And again, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Brenda Derone, the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona, about investing for retirement. And again, join in, numbers 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Allison emailed to ask if there, she says, are there any good options for people who think that most corporations are evil and want to avoid the stock market? What can you do with your money besides buy property?
I guess you could invest in crypto and, you know, gold and other commodities. I don't believe that all corporations are evil. I mean, there are socially responsible funds that avoid, you know, some of the more, you know, questionable companies out there, the tobacco, alcohol, you know, firearm companies. If you want to do that, you could, you know, invest in a socially responsible fund.
And there are some funds that I think go pretty closely to what they say they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what they've built their fund around, and that is their purpose. So I would hope that they do that.
Yeah, you mentioned cryptocurrency, and Roger had called in to ask if cryptocurrencies are good investments for retirement. What do you think about cryptocurrencies?
I think it's speculative at best. You know, I don't fully understand crypto and how it works, so I don't personally invest in it, nor would I recommend it personally. That being said, a lot of people have gotten very rich off of, you know, crypto or Bitcoin specifically. So yeah. Kudos to them.
Yeah, I also read a story here just in the last week about somebody who completely lost $100 million in crypto concern. And I'm not sure how they lost it. They couldn't get into the fund somehow.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't. It's not something I've really researched, and I want to, you know, personally, I'm not. I'm a little too risk adverse for crypto.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. For at least that's how I feel about it too. Is it easier to invest in stocks than it used to be? You know, now there's a lot of talk about investing online and that sort of thing.
Yes, it's way easier than it used to be. I mean, you used to have to call up a broker and they would have to make the trade for you, and that was the only way to do that. Now you can invest directly, you know, online. There's, you know, platforms, Robinhood, lots of different options where an individual can invest directly themselves if they want to.
But that's there again. I would not be so sure that I'd want to invest directly myself.
Just like you can perform medicine on yourself as well, I think there's definitely some value in seeing somebody who has experience and knows what they're doing.
Somebody else was asking about people who invest in the stock market and want to profit from stocks that, of course, increase in values, but others, this is where the question is, try to profit from stocks that decline in value. And I think it's called short selling.
Yep.
How does that work? How risky is that as an investment strategy?
It is riskier than investing in itself. And there's covered calls and non-covered where, you know, when you're purchasing options or selling options to somebody else, you know, if the value goes down, you can profit from that. But if it goes up and they want the stock, I mean, you're going to lose some money as well. So it is a riskier form of investing. You're using leverage, and that being said, it can definitely work out, and those that are experienced in doing it can help guide you.
Oh man, I would. Well, I'm exhibiting my lack of knowledge and understanding of this, and it's like the kind of thing that I would not do myself, for sure. We got a 55-year-old who has not done any investing, and wants to now start saving for retirement. When you're that age, What is the kind of strategy that you would employ with that person?
Put as much away as you can. Delay retirement. I'd also look at, you know, delaying Social Security for as long as you can, and try to stay healthy so they can work, you know, as long as they can. I mean, if they continued to work till 70 or 75 and had a, you know, a 20-year investing horizon, they could make up, you know, some of that delay in doing that. If they want to retire at 60, good luck.
Yeah, for sure. Bill in Wisconsin Rapids has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hello. What do you think about investing in silver coins?
I mean, silver, I know, has had a good run lately. I mean, again, it's an individual investment that really depends, you know, on your circumstance. And, you know, precious metals have seen quite a good run. They're seen as a safe haven right now with the, you know, the market going up and being at a really high multiple. Some people see that as a, you know, place to be, and it's done well in the last 6 months to a year, but I don't know.
If you look at the long term, I mean, gold comes into play on that. Thanks for calling, Bill, by the way. Gold comes into play too, but if you look long term, I mean, if you're using it as a long term investment, I have been told that it is not nearly as good as the market.
Yeah, I mean, last year, 18 months, it's done very well, and it's seen as a safe haven that holds value. But, you know, it doesn't pay dividends, and it's, in my opinion, ability to increase in value dramatically is limited. It's just based on, you know, what people prescribe its value as.
What about a home as an investment strategy? Buying a home?
I mean, honestly, that has helped a lot of Americans build, you know, build equity, assuming you have a mortgage. It's a forced savings vehicle. As you pay off your mortgage, your home equity then is value that you can tap, you know, later in life. You can downsize, go to a smaller home. Most real estate has, home real estate has appreciated, you know, in value over the last 20 years. So, I think it makes a lot of sense for individuals to own a home. I know it's a lot harder to get into a home than it used to be, too.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what the rates depend a lot, I assume, on how much down payment you have and that sort of thing.
The mortgage rates are more based on the, you know, 10-year treasury and, you know, federal rates that are, I'd say, in recent years, historically high. But yeah, the more debt you have based on how much equity you put down or down payment you put down is going to affect things as well.
Yeah. I think my rate is 2.9%.
You got in at a good time and, got while the getting's good. You're not going to be able to get that for at least for a while.
Forever, probably.
And maybe not in your lifetime.
And I'm not going to be selling my house anytime soon, because then I'd have to pay, what, 6? Perhaps. I don't know what the rate is now.
Yeah, I think a 30-year is even closer to 7 right now.
Oh boy. So if you are... I've got a daughter who's 21 years old. She's doing a little savings. But if you're that age, how would you advise a young person in terms of investing?
For your daughter at her age, assuming that she's got some earned income, I think doing a Roth IRA, you know, especially now while she still can, before, you know, she may get out of the phase out limits, would be a great way to do that. And, you know, a couple well-balanced, accounts, mutual funds. She's got a lot of time, before she's going to need that for retirement. So being able to take some risk, let it grow and ride, you know, the stock market for the next 40 years would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And then that money would, on a Roth, would be coming out all in no taxes.
Income tax free in the future. Yeah.
And I think she still has money left in a 529 account. I think she would be able to transfer that if she wanted to from her some of the money from the 529 account, if I'm not mistaken.
Depends if she's just the beneficiary of it or is she the owner of it. There are some rules that she would want to check on that, and I'm not exactly certain.
Dan emailed to say they have heard that starting to draw from a pension as soon as you can is a good idea, even if you are penalized for drawing before normal retirement age, because it's more important to draw for more years.
it just comes down to math. And what is, you know, what's the difference in the payment for starting early versus later, and then how long are you going to live? If you can, they'll have those answers, and then you can factor in when you think you're, you know, going to die, and it becomes a math equation, and you can see if it makes more sense or not.
Yeah, I know that's a question that often comes up, even with Social Security. Should I, you know, I'm in a pretty good shape. Should I just hold off on my Social Security?
Yeah, and I mean, generally, in my opinion, it's better to at least wait until you're, you know, 67 or your normal retirement age. But for most people, if they're in good health, waiting, you know, and delaying till 70 makes sense. On the pension, you know, a lot of people have options for joint, so to cover the spouse or not, and that's. That's one thing that we look at a lot in our business and help advisors figure out is, you know, you can do what's called a pension maximization, or you take it on one life, but you have life insurance to help supplement if they die early. So there's some strategies that one can look at it, but it comes down to a math problem. And if you get the variables right, you can figure out the math problem.
Yeah, it's... It's an interesting way to look at it. You know, do you take out, I know for state retirement, for example, if the spouse sits down with the owner of the quote owner and is there present for those conversations, I know. And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I believe, I mean, if a financial advisor's meeting with, you should have, you know, both partners or both the spouses present, and occasionally include the children too. If the goal is to, you know, transfer wealth to the next generation, they should be involved in that process as well and make sure that, you know, everybody's on the same page.
And just quickly, Sherry in Menominee wonders if you withdraw, the bank says you must withdraw after retirement. Can you put it into a Roth?
I guess I don't know. I don't know why the bank, did she work at a bank or?
Not sure. And here we are.
If it's in an IRA, you can do a conversion to a Roth, but you've got to pay taxes. Otherwise, you have to have earned income to contribute to a Roth.
You need earned income. There you go. On that note, Brendan, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I appreciate it. I hope we can do this again down the road. Thanks, Brendan.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Brendan Derone is the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. It's great talking with him. And coming up, we're going to talk a little about daylight savings time. How are you sleeping these days? I'm Larry Mueller. Well, did you spring forward? Did you fall back? One time, when I was about 19 years old, I got it confused in the fall, and I set my clock ahead an hour instead of back, and then I showed up 2 hours early for an event. Oh, man. And it's always a hassle for me. I bet it's a hassle for you. It's a hassle for a lot of people, this changing. Is it any good for us? And we got some really interesting thoughts, I think, today from our next guest, Rochelle Wilson-Tolomar, our guest, a lecturer in Spanish Environmental Cultural Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation. And she has some thoughts about how to look at this whole business of daylight savings time and not, and our biological clocks, and how that might relate to our environment. And I'm wondering, as I talk with her, I hope you'll join in. How do you feel about daylight savings time? How does it affect you? You can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And Rochelle Wilson-Tolomar, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to talk about this with everybody.
Yeah. You know, we turn back our clocks an hour for daylight savings time. We spring ahead, we fall back. We get an extra hour of sleep in the fall, maybe, but why do we do that?
Right? You know, it is interesting because when you look at it from the biological perspective, which I wrote in this article, as far as we know, we are the only species to do this. We are the only ones who attempt to override our natural biological presets in an attempt to extend our workday. No other being does this. They eat, they sleep, they reproduce according to their own biological rhythms. Instead of us leaning into that, you know, making our economy fit nature, we try to make nature obey our economy. And in doing so, we forget that our bodies are not expressions of capitalism. We're expressions of nature. And this article brings us back to that through indigenous knowledges.
It's a really interesting article that you've written. Yeah, we are the only species. I guess it started, is it true that it started way back in the farm days when it was thought to give farmers more time to work in the fields and so forth?
You know, whenever I was writing this article, it was actually pretty difficult to figure out exactly where it came from. There were all sorts of debates, but what I took away from this was almost all of the debates that I read, including this one that you mentioned, they're very productivity and profit-based. It's all about how do we extract maximum productivity out of not only people, but out of nature? How can we work the land more? And in that, I wanted to add a different argument. You know, a lot of us have feelings about daylight saving time. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Some people dread it. And I thought, okay, this opens up a space for us to have an additional conversation, and one that's more ecologically based. And that's where I tried to turn it.
Yeah, and it's a different the indigenous ecological perspective is different.
It is. And I was really bothered that I had never really heard this side before, and it always struck me as this is so strange that we try to change nature. Why was that the logical thing that we chose to do?
So what are we overlooking here? I mean, if the natural world provides needs longer periods of darkness, I think is what you're saying, doesn't that mean that the rest of the people do as well?
Right. What are we missing? When you look at daylight saving time, it's tempting to think it's just a technical adjustment. 1 hour back, 1 hour forward. But really, when you look at it and you try to break down the logic, you can see that it's a cultural statement that speaks to the way we humans interact with our environment, with time, and with nature. And what we're missing is that in indigenous knowledges, those interactions are based in harmony and are based in balance. When you look at daylight saving times, it is based in prioritizing work over well-being and profits over rest. We are completely missing that point.
And so, as in the indigenous area, the thought is work less in those times of the... I'm trying to wrap my head around what you're getting.
Right. So I guess there's a philosophical aspect to it when you talk about work. So what does it mean in indigenous communities about work? That is where the big friction comes in. In indigenous traditional economies, work is much more expansive. It means there's essentially one sphere. All the work that is done, that being caring for people, caring for the land, caring for young children, that's all equally valued as work. And that's because the purpose of an indigenous economy is the well-being of all. In all meaning, all humans and all the earth. However, so on the flip side, when you look at daylight saving time, its objective is to increase profits, and its objective is to aid a very particular type of worker, one that works from 9 to 5. Certainly, that worker has more daylight. That is true. Some workers, through daylight saving time, are pushed more into the light, and others are pushed more into the dark because we have a very exclusive vision of what work is. You know, for example, on Sunday morning, I got up at 4:45 with my children. I was further in the dark. I didn't get extra daylight hours. And that, you know, is a type of work that's not honored in our economy.
Yeah.
On the flip side, my husband has what you would think of as, you know, real work, the paid work, the salaried work. His job is also not considered in daylight saving time. He works 24-hour shifts once every 7 days. And without fail, like 7 of the last 8 years, his shift has fallen on daylight saving time.
Oh.
So he has worked an extra hour in the dark. And you think, okay, big deal, 1 extra hour. I stay an hour extra at my job occasionally. Will you do that and tell me how you feel on your 25th hour in the dark? It doesn't feel so good. So my point is that, you know, we don't think of everybody. We are creating social imbalance. We're creating ecological imbalance. And it opens a space to have a conversation of, okay, what could we do? What would allow for more balance? Maybe working less during days that have less daylight, you know, instead of trying to maintain this linear expression of work where we work the same number of hours, we're constantly available, we're constantly output. And in an indigenous community, there would be more room for cyclical changes. Maybe we work a little less here, a little more there. That's more typical of our natural rhythms, to have cycles. And yet we, you know, sort of obsess as a culture to try to keep up productivity and keep going no matter what and infinitely increase.
Gary in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Gary, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I have always dreaded the day when we have to set the clocks back an hour, because that means, you know, it's pitch black at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I have seasonal affective disorder. And so, you know, that made it even worse. I should add, I'm retired. And I set my own schedule, obviously. So this year, it finally dawned on me, there's a law that says we have to set the clocks back. So I didn't. My own little act of personal protest. I'm still an hour ahead of everybody else.
How does it feel?
And I am loving it, especially at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when I look out and it's still nice and bright and sunny.
Gary, I love that. So what do you think, Rochelle?
I think we all have our versions of protest. Yours, it sounds lovely. Mine was writing and trying to spark some debate about this of why do we do this, and do we even want to do this? What kind of future are we creating when our concept of time values the market instead of our lives?
Gary, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I love that. I love your thoughts on that. Hey, you're retired. You just live on your own clock. I actually thought about the big changes, and people are now working more from home, that this can make a difference in people's lives, those who work at home, because you don't all right, maybe you need to work 8 hours, but you can adjust those hours a bit.
Right. There's definitely more flexibility for certain types of workers. I worked remotely this past semester as a lecturer for UW, and yeah, I could have arranged where I caught up on my work later in the day. But, you know, many workers in our economy don't have that choice. For example, there's an entire economy dedicated to supporting the 9-to-5 workers. You can think about the food industry. They're getting up an hour early to make, you know, their profits earlier as workers are getting their, maybe getting a coffee earlier. Transportation workers, working the bus, working trains, they're up earlier. They can't benefit from any sort of remote type of work, which once again goes back to this practice is very exclusive in what type of work it's acknowledging and what type of work it's helping. It helps some and it hurts others.
I can tell you the same holds true for radio hosts.
You do have a schedule.
We have a schedule and we have to... I can't show up an hour late for the radio show.
No.
Or an hour early.
No, you cannot. And I guess that's why we've invented things like fluorescent lights and caffeine. We attempt to override our natural need for rest, however possible, besides resting.
Dennis in Two Rivers. We'll go to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I suppose this could be a question for Jamie Knack also, but as far as when I remember about the height of the pandemic, some of the wildlife would move further into the urban and suburban areas. So I wonder when there are changes where people are commuting or shopping differently, does that possibly change how close animals get to homes and roads?
Yeah, I have, I guess, an anecdotal response to that. And I live in Minneapolis, and I drove into Madison for this interview. It is a straight, boring drive in which I normally remember nothing about it. However, this time I was struck, I guess pun intended, by how many deer were on the side of the road that had been hit. And when I stopped for gas, I read a headline about how there are more deer collisions after daylight saving time, because obviously nature doesn't get the memo that our rhythms have moved earlier into the dawn. And that's an ecological impact there. I think I counted 6 or 7 on my drive.
Well, there was a report, a research done by Environment Colorado that in their work, they found that collisions between motor vehicles and deer increase 16% in the week following the spring and fall time changes.
So they need a week to adjust and learn that we've changed too, I guess.
So an amazing, amazing number. Tim in New Berlin emailed to say that every study proves that children do better in school when they can sleep when they were meant to. And daylight savings time disrupts a child's education. Sounds like you would probably agree with that.
I was going to say this fits almost perfectly into my argument. And to bring it back to what this comment gets us to, according to Indigenous knowledges, something that is quite pervasive in our culture is that we view ourselves as completely separate and superior from nature, which is what fuels practices like daylight saving time, where we view that we can do something that is not coherent with our nature. Indigenous knowledges could be like illustrated more so by a circle. We view humans as just a mere point on that circle, just in the same way as a tree or water, air. We are an equal part of nature. And like these children who need to rest, reminding ourselves that we're a part of nature would bring us back to more natural, more restful rhythms, including, you know, how it plays out in education. I did teach last semester at UW a course on culture and environment and economy. And something that we talked about consistently was how our culture believes we're separate from nature. We view nature as something way out there that we can travel to, maybe a park that's fenced in, maybe a mountain to go visit. We forget that our bodies are expressions of nature. They are not expressions of capitalism. And when I had a group presenting at the end of the semester and they said, okay, class, draw a picture of nature. I was the only person in that room to include a human in my image. And these are ecologically conscientious students that are taking my course. It is so pervasive, this belief that we are separate, that indigenous knowledges tend to intercede and remind us that we are a part of the grander ecology. And that goes back to this commentator's point mm-hmm. that children need to rest more too.
Michael emailed to say, without clocks, we couldn't have daylight savings time.
Yes.
Yet the amount of daylight remains the same.
Yes.
So daylight savings time, he's agreeing with you, he says, is a product of capitalism.
I
mean, we kind of invented, time is this, clocks, or, you know, we invented them.
Right. With the inception of capitalism and the invention of the clock, they kind of worked together in the sense that it suddenly became possible to measure and manage worker productivity, and it just simply wasn't possible before that. As a result, this new logic has arisen out of, you know, the clock and capitalism, and that logic is infinite extraction, both of, you can see that, the way we treat our earth, what we take from it without limits, and what we expect from our workers to be constantly available, to be constantly outputting, and to not rest. These, the clock and capitalism, what you have to think about in not just daylight saving times, but it's a logic, and this logic is copy-pasted across small practices and large practices, and it's all about looking at that logic and seeing how it's incompatible with nature, which is what I do in this article, showing how daylight saving time is just one practice that we probably need to reevaluate and realign with nature.
Do you think that's possible? Do you think we're going to be able to do that?
I would love if it were possible. I do believe the first step is having conversations about it, and that conversation should probably revolve around what kind of future do we want and what kind of economy could make that future happen.
So we need an economy that values rest as much as productivity, perhaps.
Right, right.
Or care as much as profit.
Exactly. You know, I think we need an economy that works for all. And I use the word all in the indigenous sense, meaning all expressions of human, not just a particular type of human doing a certain type of work. And all, meaning all the earth. What kind of economy can, you know, take in the social and ecological costs as well? We tend to measure economies by GDP only. We look at profit only. And it excludes the social and ecological side. There are other ways of looking at economies. A lot of scholars across fields have debated, well, why do we use the GDP? Shouldn't we use, for example, the general well-being, which takes into account how people are doing, how the earth is doing? For instance, if we use that mode of measurement, what we consider a developed nation, that list, it might be totally it would look totally different. Which countries are considered the best if we used a different model of measurement?
Jim in Winnebago County has something for us. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Well, I have a couple things to say. One is that clocks are an artificial construct of humans. And so unless we are going to actually just let our natural rhythms go and not use clocks, this is sort of an interesting topic, but it's not going to go anywhere. Personally, I like daylight saving time a lot. Now, I'm not part of the economy because I'm retired, but I really appreciate being able to spend as much time in the evening outdoors during the summer when the days are longest anyway. And I do agree that there is too much emphasis and maybe negative emphasis on educational clocks and that it may actually cause problem for learning. I know that as a student and even as a faculty member, I didn't particularly like 8 o'clock morning classes or 7:45s either. But the fact of the matter is that we all do live by clocks, and the proposal that we just stay on daylight saving time forever is just actually kicking the can down the road anyway. So I favor it. I like it, and I hope it stays just as it is.
You bring up a good. You said something. It's not going anywhere, and while I hear what you're saying, this discussion about daylight saving time does connect to a grander conversation about cultures of overwork. If you look, for instance, in Spain, they recently passed a law called the Right to Disconnect, where it's now illegal to contact your workers outside of work hours. They are not required to be available via email or Zoom or whatnot. You could look at Iceland. They piloted a 4-day work week. They are going to stick with the 4-day work week because they found that it worked better for them. There are ways of adjusting our culture of overwork. And I do think that we are going somewhere. I think this is a conversation that unifies people who believe they need more rest and more balance in their lives.
Well, so I think many states, not Wisconsin, but many states, nearly every other state, I think, has acted to end daylight savings time. What do you think about replacing it with the permanent standard time? Does that make any difference in the as you're describing and talking about it?
I mean, I would be an advocate for it. I would love if we stopped trying to manipulate nature in small and big ways like this, for sure.
So in the end, what's your takeaway here?
My takeaway is that if we stopped trying to bend nature and make nature obey the economy, I believe that we could not only find more rest, but find more meaning, find more sustainability, find a more desirable future for ourselves and for the next generation.
So we should take a look at what others are doing, other countries maybe?
Why not, right? I would love a 4-day work week.
Well, I guess it would be hard for me to get think that way because of the show that I do.
Well,
it would be hard.
Yeah, I mean, going from one way of life to another way of life always requires a big adjustment, and I think thinking about that is step one, and implementation is step two.
Well, it involves a lot of conversation to change minds in that fashion.
Absolutely.
You would agree with that.
Absolutely.
On that note, here we are out of time, and there were some other callers. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but Rochelle, it's been a pleasure talking
with
you.
It has been a pleasure. I'm so happy to see Indigenous knowledges being mainstream.
Rochelle Wilson Tolomar. Our guest, lecturer in Spanish Environmental Cultural Studies at the UW-Madison, enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation. It was fun to look at this from a different perspective. Fun for me, and I hope it was fun for you. And we're going to continue our show. Of course, we're not going anywhere. We'll be talking about some really cool research on truffles. You know, we spend a lot of money on truffles when we go to the restaurant or at the grocery store. We have them growing right here in Wisconsin. Did you know that? We'll find out about the research going on next. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to truffle. It's, how would you describe it? Kind of an earthy flavor, I think. Think and aroma, and that's before you cook them. And I tell you what, I did not know that we had truffles growing in our state. I should have known that, but I didn't. So it was kind of a surprise to me. And we'll be talking the next half hour here about truffles with two truffle researchers from UW La Crosse. Arthur Group, one of them, an assistant professor of biology, specializes in mycology and fungal ecology. Arthur, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
I tell you what, it's exciting for me, too. Mariah Rogers is our other guest, a graduate student and also president of the Wisconsin Mycological Society, which is dedicated to the study and enjoyment of mushrooms and other fungi throughout the state. Mariah, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much, Larry.
So, do you like the taste of truffles as you listen in? Have you ever gone truffle hunting in Wisconsin? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Arthur, you and Mariah have traveled throughout Wisconsin documenting the prevalence of truffles. Why truffles?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Truffles are, so most people are familiar with mushrooms, the iconic toadstool that we see, the white cap with the, or the red cap with the white spots. But there's a whole other group of fungi that are more cryptic, and we call them truffles because they have a closed fruiting body, so they stay closed at maturity, and they generally fruit underground. And so most folks who are mushroom hunters really don't have them on their radar, and only a select amount of fungal biologists really kind of went down the rabbit hole to find, to look for truffles. And so there's a lot of truffle diversity that we don't know about. And so part of what Mariah and I and others have been looking for is to try and document the truffle biodiversity in our local areas. And Wisconsin is one of those places where we don't really have a lot of records in the museums about what truffles occur here, even though we know based on collections from Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, that there's truffles surrounding the state.
Mariah, you, mycology, the study of fungi, of course, and what is special? You study, you can study them all, but what's so special for you about truffles?
Well, the first thing was that just like you, I had been interested in fungi for such, you know, number of years, but I hadn't ever thought to dig for them. And so I was coming into the graduate program and I was looking to go to UW-La Crosse and looked at the research by Arthur Group and saw truffles on there. And I saw truffle species in places like Tennessee, Florida. And I was like, oh, not just the West Coast, not just Europe. And looking deeper into it, going down that rabbit hole, it's like there's this whole other world to get into. And it's a world that connects to animals because they're digging them up and eating them. And it's a world that connects to trees because they form relationships with them. So it's this, you get right at the center of the food web. You're also going underground, which is a place I'd never gone before for fungi. And it's just like it feels like a frontier on top of a frontier, which is just really fun.
So how abundant are truffles in Wisconsin and maybe the Midwest? Do we have any kind of handle on it? And I'm also, well, I'll just start with that. I have another follow-up to that, but let's start with that.
Well, Arthur can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say we have the beginning of half of a handle.
Half of a handle. What do you think, Arthur?
Yeah, so actually one of Mariah's chapters that we're both very excited about and kind of creates this foundational work is Mariah is in the process of looking at various platforms and records to get an idea of what truffles actually occur in Wisconsin, which truffles occur in the Midwest area, so Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, to just create this preliminary biodiversity list of truffles that we can then use to start, you know, making questions like, okay, if we see these sort of truffle fungi around us, then there's a good chance we can start looking for them here and kind of guide our inquiry into what's in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and there have been some collections, a lot of them made with the Bonito Lab at Michigan State University, Dr. Greg Bonito and his graduate students and students there. And also, I really appreciate all the collections that were made by Dr. Roseanne Healy throughout the Midwest. Like, she's probably why truffles are on the map in Iowa, so far as I know.
Well, how, you know, if they're underground, how, I mean, it's, they got to be hard to find.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's, I liken it a lot to a spidey sense where you're just wandering around looking for truffles and you just get this little itch, this little tingle that maybe that patch over the of dirt over there might have some truffles. And so I'll go out and start raking the ground and see what I can turn up. And probably 20 times out of 30, there's nothing there. And so then you just have to keep going. Some people are more gifted at it than others, but you know, watching a trained truffle dog work is, they're so much better at finding these things than we are as people because of the smells that these things give off and the training of the dogs with those smells.
That is amazing to me because there's not, I mean, is there anything on the surface of the ground? I mean, if I went out to look for truffles, Mariah.
Yeah, there's a couple things that you can look for. The first one is like looking for any fungus that's associated with a specific set of trees. You kind of start to hunt the trees. Morel hunters know what I'm talking about. So if you know, oh, truffles are often associated with oaks around the world. Okay, let's go look in the area around oak trees where maybe their root tips might be, where that mycelium is connecting to those root tips, and that's where the truffles tend to form. So you can start by looking at, if you think there's an associated tree relationship, look for the tree. And then the second thing would be look for the soil. I have a rule that if I'm not having a good time digging, the little squirrels and voles and things that eat the truffles probably also aren't having a good time digging, and that's bad for the truffles, so it's probably not there. The third, so nice loose soil. They like sandy loam, so look for that. And then pH relationships. They tend to like an alkaline soil. So this is less of like a visual thing, but you could get your pH meter out or look at maps and kind of look at that. So there's all these sort of environmental signals and signs you can narrow down and on. And then you could be lucky and see, say, a flying squirrel scratching around under a tree. And if you see one of those animals that are really dependent on eating fungi in their diet going ham, like really digging, they might have a truffle. A lot of times, apparently, they dig more voraciously when they're going after a truffle versus just like a nut or something. So check it out. Check out their little digs. So you can actually spot the digs too. Not like a tunnel in the ground, not like their burrow,
yeah,
but like
scratching.
And then look around, little scratches.
Jane in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Larry. I've got a question for your guests. My niece lives in the South, and she has started a truffle farm. So she has purchased infused trees and planted like 400. She's wanting to train dogs to harvest the truffles. Do you have a suggestion for a certain breed of dog? And is there a better age to start them at? Do you take a mature dog, or do you just start with puppies? That's my question.
All right.
Well, I would say that you can train just about any kind of dog to be a truffle hunting dog. It works really well if the dogs want to work and you have a really good working relationship with them. I know some dogs are more inclined just from their history and their breeding to be truffle dogs, but I know folks have trained labs, all sorts of other dogs to be truffle dogs, and it really comes down to engaging them in the game of finding truffles. And so you find what motivates the dog, food, play, and you start training them with truffles that smell like the ones you might find. There's some really great videos online. Alyssa at Truffle Dog Company does a lot of training on the West Coast that has, she sells a lot of aids. There's all sorts of folks. It's really pretty accessible in terms of finding resources and then trying to start finding local areas. It's not that hard, I think, to adapt someone who's training hunting dogs to start training dogs to hunt for truffles.
Oh yeah, be the same. A lot of the same, probably the same techniques you'd use for training a dog, I would think, for pheasant hunting or something, would apply to truffles.
And in general, they'll call that scent work. So if you were looking for a trainer who specializes in scent work, that might be something. I've also heard the tip that training dogs on fresh truffles is going to work better than like dried or truffle oil, even though you could try those other things.
Jane, thanks. I didn't even know there were such things as truffle farms.
Yes, there are. And there are truffle farms. I would say that Arthur can maybe speak more about this in North America, but the history of them kind of begins in Europe, where they are first digging them up, foraging, and then noticing the association with trees, and then deliberately making a slurry mix, like a smoothie, basically, of the truffles, and then pouring it around their trees, and then you can put them with your orchard trees.
Jane, thanks again. Danny in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
Well, a lot. You know, I think I might have heard, I'm 79 years old now, and I think I might have heard about truffles when I was growing up somewhere along the line. How about when I get off the phone with you, can your guest give a 101 on what truffles is, you know, according to the definition, which I might have missed because I just tuned in. And the other thing is, have they explored chocolate-covered truffles yet?
Well, that's not that. That, Danny, I think we sort of touched on that, but maybe describe truffles and their value. Arthur, do you want to start?
Sure. So a truffle is basically a closed fruiting body. So if you think about a mushroom like a portobello or a shiitake or an oyster mushroom, they open up at maturity and they're going to actively release their spores. Truffle fungi are when they don't open at maturity. They stay closed in these closed fruiting bodies. And rather than being able to actively disperse their spores like a shiitake would, they have these really desirable odors that come off of them that are cues for their animal dispersal. So, you know, it's like I'm walking down the street and I start smelling a cheeseburger. I'm looking around for where that's coming from and I'm getting hungry. Very similarly, these truffles put off smells that indicate food to animals. And so they rely on the animals to consume them and then scatter their spores in the process.
I describe them as a stinky nugget underground. That's a fungus.
Have you? All right. What about the chocolate covered truffles?
Haven't really explored that. I think they're just absolutely delicious when you get them fresh and you can shave little pieces on like a really rich pasta dish with a nice Alfredo sauce. I've put it on top of, you know, my favorite slice of pizza. I've made butter with it. Actually, we even made ice cream with our collaborators that came to visit to help us look for truffles around here.
Very, very cool. I've got more questions, but just a reminder to everybody, Arthur Group, an assistant professor of biology at UW-La Crosse, and Mariah Rogers, who's a graduate student at UW-La Crosse and president of the Wisconsin Mycological Society, our guests, as we talk truffles. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk truffles with our two guests, Arthur Group and Mariah Rogers from the UW-La Crosse. They're doing research in this area. And Mariah, this fall in Bayfield, I understand you discovered a previously undescribed species of truffle. Tell us about that.
Well, the first thing I would note is that I was sort of very privileged and lucky to be shooting fish in a barrel, so to speak. My good friend, Arnie Martinson, also on the board of the Wisconsin Mycological Society and a community mycologist and resident of Bayfield, had already been interested in truffles, and he knew that flying squirrels in his area might be eating them. So he had been looking, watching them, as you do, and he noticed that they were digging under a hazelnut tree on his family's property. He dug there, and in just that first couple inches of sandy soil, there were truffles. And when I said, oh, I'm going to be studying truffles, he said, well, how about you come dig around here? And we collected more. And that's the thing. It's undescribed, but not necessarily previously unfound. I think even Wisconsin residents may have been turning up these plenty of times. It's just a matter of description is going to take us more careful work with the sequences and describing like their features and their geographical range. So it's a lot more work than just the finding of it, but the finding of it is really special to me because it happened with the help of a friend and at a place that the Wisconsin Mycological Society goes for one of our big retreat forays that was already pretty special to me.
And, so that's really cool. And it was associated with a particular tree.
Yeah, with hazelnuts, which was also a good bet if, as I believe Arnie had also read about truffles in Europe and truffles in Europe associated with hazelnuts, it's not too much of a stretch to think, oh, our native hazelnut species here might have truffles of their own.
Diane in Portage has a question. Diane, go ahead.
Hi, Larry, the other day you had someone on talking about mushrooms, and one of your callers and the person you were with both brought up the point that mushrooms should be cooked to be used and that they can cause problems if not. I was interested because I have that problem. I can't eat raw mushrooms. But are truffles the same way?
Yeah, Mariah?
So your problem with mushrooms in general might be down to chitin, and that would be this substance that's in the cell walls of every single fungal species. And it's kind of like how some people are bothered by a lot of fiber or some people are bothered by raw onions, just sort of a rejection of that substance. And when you cook it, any mushroom, you're breaking down that chitin. That's would be my best first guess for just like across the board problems with mushrooms. But then on top of that, once you start talking about the average mushroom that you are foraging or buying in the grocery store, many of them can actually be toxic raw, but edible cooked. So morel mushrooms are one of those. They can actually make you very sick if you eat them raw, and it's actually caused major poisonings before. But if you cook them, it breaks the substance in them that's actually still kind of a mystery down, and you're able to eat them, and they're delicious. They also just taste better cooked all the way. Then there's mushrooms out there that are not only safe raw, but considered choice or better raw, as long as your body can handle it. The advice I give people when they come on forays with WMS is to eat, be really, really sure what you have. And then with the first time you use guidelines of like, look it up. How do people cook this? Is it acceptable to eat it raw? And then if you do want to try it raw, consider, does it have gunky dirt on it? If yes, maybe consider cooking it anyway. And then fourth point, first time you're trying something new, you know, you try a little bit. You might have an intolerance to it. You might have an allergy. And then after that, you can kind of
go from there.
Yeah.
Go from there.
Ease yourself in. Yeah.
Adam in Middleton wondered, does harvesting truffles harm the trees they grow under? Arthur, do you want to comment?
Yeah. So, interestingly, it doesn't really harm the fungus. So whenever you see a mushroom, a big mushroom growing out there, or a truffle, for instance, that's kind of analogous in a way to an apple on a tree. If you pick the apple on the tree, you're not hurting the tree. If you pick the mushroom, you're not hurting the mushroom, because most of its body is actually microscopic. And it's the hyphae or mycelium people talk about. And so they just produce those mushrooms in order to release their spores. So that being said, you know, there's ethical guidelines in terms of not harvesting all the mushrooms that you may want to eat in an area because of, you know, you may have a long-term impact, but ethically harvesting them in a way that leaves some behind and doesn't really take everything is my rule for when I go out foraging.
Mm-hmm. And Mariah, to add to that?
Yeah, there's a... also a point to be said that when you're like digging up or digging through the duff, so the leaf litter and things on top of the soil, you're digging into the soil, you replace that. And that would be that you're not leaving these bare patches where there weren't any before that might, you know, expose roots. And another thing is, it's kind of common sense, but anytime you cut into the bigger roots of a tree, you're exposing that tree to potential pathogens. So if you want to keep your tree safe, don't like hack into the larger roots. The little root tips, okay, but yeah. That would be how you would stay safe, keep your tree safe.
Jim and Larson emailed, since many fungi produce fruiting bodies only when the symbiotic host is dying, Is this the case with truffles as well? Doesn't sound like it.
No. So truffles require a living host tree, and that's their host is how they actually get sugars. The tree trades sugars from photosynthesis to its fungal partner, the truffle, and other groups in exchange for getting access to water and essential nutrients in the soil. And so in this situation, the truffle very much does not want the tree to die.
Yeah. And my experience with that concept with morel mush is usually with morel mushrooms that people talk about the tree that the mushroom might have been, the morel mushroom might have been associating with dying, and it just seems to flush a lot. But that's a species that tends to kind of have a debate about whether it's decaying the wood of the tree or it's associating like the truffle does, like an ectomycorrhizal association with the tree. And it might be doing both, and that might be kind of like where people hear that with morels. But every fungus is different. Like even some truffles out there that aren't the like classic culinary tuber truffles, there are loads of other weirdos out there, and they could have very different ecologies.
And are all truffles safe to eat if properly prepared, or are there poisonous truffles like there are other poisonous mushrooms?
Yeah, so that's an important question. I would say that some of them are worth eating, specifically true truffles in the genus tuber, like what Mariah is working on. Those are safe to eat. There's a lot of other things that look like truffles that aren't worth eating and may have caused some gastrointestinal distress for folks. It's also important to, if you think you have a truffle, to cut it in half before you eat it to look and see if it's actually a truffle fungus or if it's just a little baby mushroom of some other variety that might be potentially toxic.
Oh, so what is the insight when you cut it in half? How do you tell?
So for the true truffles, when you cut them in half, they have this thing called a marbling in them. They'll have like these lighter colored veins, and then they'll have these pockets of darker colored spores around them. And so that marbling is a really good indication that you have a true truffle, but there are also some lookalikes depending on the age of it. And so my rule is when in doubt, throw it out.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of resources for folks to look up and pictures that can be taken and sent for identification.
And you can come on the trails with us in the Wisconsin Mycological Society.
I wanted to bring that up. We have a lot of folks interested in mushrooms, and I imagine the Wisconsin Mycological Society would be a good source. You probably have a website.
Absolutely. And I really recommend that for anyone getting into eating fungi in general. If not WMS, try Minnesota Mycological Society, Illinois Mycological Association. There's all sorts of different little regional clubs and societies that you can get into. And that's where you're going to get your hands on the mushrooms with other people who are familiar.
Yeah.
And that's where learning happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go just on the basis of photos.
Right.
You want to get your hands on it and look and smell and before you do any tasting.
Definitely.
For sure. Well, the Wisconsin Mycological Society would be a place to go for sure. Arthur and Mariah, thank you both very much for spending time to be with us today. I appreciate it. We should do this again down the road. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, and your team for having us. Really appreciate it. And thanks to your listeners.
Arthur Group and Mariah Rogers. Mariah is a grad student at UW La Crosse and president of the Wisconsin Mycological Society, and Arthur, an assistant professor of biology at UW La Crosse. Big thanks to listening. A big thanks to our team, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.